October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. If you haven't already, please watch and share Misty's domestic violence video, Escape. The link is on our Facebook page. Thanks in advance for doing your part to support this worthwhile cause.
Well, so, you're one of my mom's favorite magicians in the whole wide world, Smarty Pants, and I want to see you do what she says you can do, so tell me, what am I thinking right now?
You're looking at the pants that I'm wearing and wondering maybe those really are Smarty Pants.
Oh my God, he's a deity!
One thing
you don't have enough time on this podcast.
One thing. I told Trisha Lasky I suck at dribbling basketballs. What do you stink at? What are you terrible
dribbling
at?
Basketballs would
you can't
would
take
be...
mine.
I will
no.
teach you both how come to up. Dribble a basketball.
Come up with your own. What, real quick, just give me something.
And
that
anything
you're
involving
at.
Sports.
Great. That's all I needed. Thank you. I will let you off the hook with that. Because I needed to feel better about myself. I needed to know that you had some kind of flaw.
Okay.
Thank you.
I got plenty.
If you do not excel in the athleticism, although you can dance.
Yeah, I don't believe it.
I don't either. I don't believe he's bad at anything.
But having made the decision to pursue this as a profession, I promptly started starving because there wasn't any work. The nightclub industry had dried up by that point. There were a handful of jazz clubs around, but not much else. You know, there just weren't markets, at least not that I knew of. So I was trying to find work, but not being very successful with it. Mm. And there was a place in Boston, I believe it still exists, although the last I heard it still existed, but all the names had been changed. But there were three nightclubs in one building.
Okay.
And at that time, one of the clubs was called, the big club in front was called Lucifer.
Love it.
Yep. And then there was a club on the side of the building called Katie's.
Okay.
And in the back was a club called Yesterday. And these clubs had changed identity a number of times, both in terms of names, but also in terms of definitions. But at that time, in the early 70s, Lucifer had show bands. Katie's had rock bands. And Yesterday was a disco, but this is before the Travolta. This is when disco was still a bit underground.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember Lucifer's were there circa 1981. It was still
and I think the clubs may still be there, but I know that they changed their name at some point in the 90s, I think. Anyway, I figured I'm going to get a gig there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
It's the closest thing to a nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, armed with a deck of cards, I went and managed to get an interview with the guy who owned the club, along mm-hmm. with more than 30 other clubs up and down the East Coast.
Wow.
Henry Vara of the Vara Brothers.
Okay.
And I managed to wangle a meeting with him, and I tried to sell myself to him as to MC the show bands.
Okay.
So I would do magic and MC the shows.
Hosting kind of.
And he said, well, we don't use MCs.
Oh.
And I said, but you could. I mean, wouldn't this be a great, exciting new idea? And he really wasn't interested, but he was willing to watch some of my card tricks, which he gathered a couple of other employees around, and they liked those. And he said, you know, the waiting line to get into Katie's is long, particularly on the weekends. And I think it was like a Thursday or whatever. He said, you could do card tricks for the people waiting online, and I'll pay you to do that.
Okay.
Was not a lot of money.
But it was work.
So I said, great. So I showed up the next night, or that night, whatever. It was Friday night, I know that. And it was horrible. Nobody wanted to watch card tricks. They all wanted to get into this club, and they were all very impatient and irritated that the line wasn't moving fast enough. And the last thing they wanted was for some guy to come over and try and show them card tricks. So it was really a waste of time.
Hostile, horrible thing for close up ever.
It was pretty terrible. So
yeah, it's
dreadful.
So I worst corporate gig ever.
I was basically considering the night to be a write off. I was going to get my $20, I think, was what I was being paid. Mm-hmm. I was going to get my $20, and then it was obviously not, they weren't going to ask me back.
Oh.
You know, because I wasn't accomplishing anything. I mean, nobody wanted to see these card tricks. And the guy who was the manager of yesterday, the disco, the entrances were kitty corner. Mm-hmm. And so I'm smoking a cigarette, wondering if I should make another effort to try and get people to watch card tricks they didn't want to see, and feeling pretty miserable. And the manager of the club was a guy named Frankie, and he had been in the office when I had done the card tricks.
Mm, okay, so he knew you.
So he comes out of his club for a cigarette, and we get to chatting, and he says, how's it going? And I said, well, it's a disaster. Nobody's interested, and the only way I can perform anything is to essentially force it on people, and they'll tolerate it for a moment, and this is not a good experience for anyone. Mm-hmm. How are you doing? And he said, well, this is terrible. My disc jockey didn't come in tonight. And so I'm in the booth playing the records. This was back in the days of vinyl.
Mm-hmm. Right.
While trying to run the club. And so it's awful. I've got a long track on right now, so I've got 10 minutes or so where I don't have to be in the booth, but this is driving me nuts. And I said, well, I know how to run turntables. I have a radio show in college. I assume it's the same equipment.
Nice.
And he said, yeah, but do you know the current music? And I said, no. At that time, I'd never set foot in a disco.
Mm-hmm.
It was still, as I say, an underground thing. So he said, well, then you couldn't possibly do it. And I said, well, I think I might be able to do it, and I've been wasting my time here on doing these card tricks online. He said, well, I tell you what, he said, it would be incredible if you could, because it would free me up to do my job. yeah, come in and do it, but if the dance floor has to be full, and if you can't make that happen, then, you know, don't get mad at me when I tell you to stop.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'll give you 20 minutes, and if it works, great, but if it's not happening, I'll boot you out, and we don't argue. And
right.
I said,
mm-hmm.
fine. Mm-hmm. So I get into the booth, and there are all these records around, none of which I've heard of,
mm-hmm.
by artists none of which I've heard of, but there's a pair of headphones,
mm-hmm.
so I can screen stuff, and there are two turntables, and first of all, people are coming up to the booth and making requests.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So that's giving me a head start, right?
Right, right.
But also, I can listen on the headphones, so I can find tracks that have reasonably matching beats.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'd been in college doing the radio show, I had invented for myself, but I mean many others had come up with the same idea, but the idea of jump cutting,
mm-hmm.
which meant that mm-hmm. you went from one turntable to the other.
Sure.
You actually started one of the turntables before you turned on the volume. You cued it to where you wanted and held the record in place with your finger.
Wow.
And so you were able to match the beat.
Mm-hmm.
So when you made the transition from one song to another, the beat didn't stop.
Yeah.
Which meant there was no real end to the song.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
meant that people didn't leave the dance floor.
Right.
Oh. Yeah, these guys all have beats per minute counters.
Right.
And,
well,
and
this was very primitive compared
yeah, yeah.
to that, but it
awesome.
Worked.
Yeah.
The other thing was, since I'd never set foot into disco, I didn't know that the DJs didn't talk. there was a mic in the booth.
I
later
so
found
you were
out
like DJing like on the radio.
Yeah. I later found out the mic was only meant to be used for, you know,
Emergency
someone has lost their keys or whatever.
They leave the club.
But I didn't know, so I'm yelling stuff out at the same time as I'm doing these jump cuts. Well, the floor stayed packed for the next 3.5-4 hours. By closing time, I had a gig.
Nice.
And so I spent the next 10 months disc jockeying. At not what blossomed to not just that club, but a bunch of other Vara clubs. So I was working pretty much every night, disc jockeying, and that was going really well. But after about 10 months, I said, hold on, mm-hmm. I'm not doing what I want to do here. So I quit. Mm-hmm. In a friendly
sure.
situation, but I mean, I announced I was going to quit to become a magician and to do what I'd set out to do in the first place.
And mm-hmm. see the look of everyone.
So now, this is turning into a very long story, but
it's fantastic.
I'm walking down the street one day, and I'm walking down the street in Kenmore Square, which was the square that these clubs were located in.
Rathskeller was there too,
and there was a little jazz club, tucked away in the corner of this square,
uh-huh.
called Pooh's Pub.
I remember Pooh's Pub.
It may still exist, Pooh's although I'm
Pub,
sure it doesn't
absolutely.
Have that name. So a month or two after I quit,
uh-huh.
I'm walking through Kenmore Square, and I ran into Frankie, who was the guy who was managing the disco.
The disco guy, yeah.
A year earlier.
Smoking
and
a cigarette.
He said, Max, how are you? And I said, I'm all right. And he said, how are things coming along? Because he knew that I had resigned being a disc jockey in order mm-hmm. to pursue this career. And I said, well, I'm starving. I can't find work. And he said, on Tuesday night each week, Pooh's Pub was a jazz club. But on Tuesday, he said, we have a talent contest. And it's a $50 prize. Now, back in 1975, I think this was, that was actually a good prize.
Yeah.
He said, and I've seen your card tricks, you're really good, so why don't you come and be in the contest and you could win $50 and that would be good.
Yes.
And I said, gee, that's great, but to be honest, I'm looking for work. I'm not looking for a one-time $50 shot. He said, okay. Come and MC the talent show.
Perfect.
And I'll give you $25 a week. $25 a Tuesday.
Wow.
So
you got
so
half
I did.
What the prize winner got.
So I got to the gig every week.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And I did that for 6 months.
Wow.
Every Tuesday, and so I was breaking in material. In between the acts.
Absolutely.
And even when I couldn't find any other work, I had that Tuesday. And it was during that period that I was really transitioning from magic per se into mentalism.
Interesting.
And then after about 6 months or so, they decided to retire the contest because they were getting the same people every week.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm.
And Frankie said to me, I'm changing the format of Tuesday nights. We're going to alternate you and it was a pair of women who did music. One played the piano and they sang. He said, so I'm going to alternate. So they'll do a set and then you'll do a set and then they'll do a set and then you'll do a set. And I'll give you a raise to $30.
Wow.
And yeah, but that was 2 1-hour sets.
Mm.
So I was getting $15 a show, which is exactly what I was getting for the at my peak as a children's birthday party entertainer.
Oh no!
So so financially it was not a very good deal, but as far as a learning thing, it was incredible. I had 2 hours to fill every week, so I broke in a lot of stuff and did that for about 6 months. So the 1 year, and it was almost exactly 1 year that I spent working once every week at Pooh's Pub was the great gestation for me as far as developing a core repertoire, completing that transition into mentalism, and getting a clue as to who the hell I was on stage.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And you have a fantastically large repertoire, because I know you're such a smartass. When you did the Peller at the Magic Castle, you did, was it 6 or 9 45-minute shows and did not repeat the same material at all.
I did not.
When
know
they
that.
Opened the Peller
look at their
as
face. Look at his
when
face.
They opened the Peller as a booked mm-hmm. theater at the castle, which was
another hat you've worn,
which was only a
you
few
used to
years
book
ago.
The acts at the Magic Castle.
Well, uh-huh. someone had.
Uh-huh.
To.
There's nothing this man cannot do.
First performer in the Peller too, weren't you?
Well, yeah, and
So it was a 45-minute slot. It's normally done by two acts, but no need to go into the full story. I wound up doing it solo. And at that time, it was only two nights. It was Friday and Saturday.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so when I did it, just for my own amusement, I actually didn't spread the word around, but just for my own amusement, I did six, over the two nights, I did six 45-minute shows without repeating material.
And that's and an
none of the material was, and none of the material was part of what I do in the two-hour theater show.
Oh my gosh! So, right.
But that all came from for 13 years I headlined comedy clubs, and during that period developed a ridiculously large repertoire.
Right. Comedy clubs where?
In all over the United States.
Well, you
remember I said there were no.
You must have run into my uncle somewhere down the line because he was in Boston.
Who's your uncle?
My uncle's Joe Alasky. He's a pretty well-known
voiceover
impressionist
and comedian.
Yes. Very well-known.
He was in Boston at the same time as you, doing comedy, stand-up comedy.
Yes.
Horn-rimmed glasses, or at least at that time?
I can show you
all different kinds of glasses.
Okay. I think I'm picturing a face to it.
He started with stand-up comedy.
I think I probably did.
I'm sure.
But
must have.
As I said earlier that the nightclub industry had died, and it pretty much had, I managed to get in on the tail end of the Playboy Club circuit.
That
was in its declining days, but still healthy in some markets. And then in the late 70s, the comedy boom started.
Yeah.
And now there were suddenly all of these comedy clubs. And because I had some background of having worked with the Playboys and I had done the Merv Griffin show, I had credentials. So I didn't have to work my way up the positions as most comics did, but rather I got to enter into it as a headliner. So for 13 years, I headlined comedy clubs. And when I would headline comedy clubs all around the country, I would change my show every night. Not 100%, but I would change and mix and match the material every night. And I did this for basically three reasons. One was to keep myself interested.
I was just going to say, you bore easily, don't you?
Which was not a bad thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The second, and equally important, was to keep the employees interested. Because most comedians who were headlining these clubs had a set routine, and after
every
the third
week.
Night, the employees could recite it with them.
Mm-hmm.
Which, whereas with my stuff, they would see stuff they hadn't seen, and it kept them invigorated. Mm-hmm. And that's an important secret to nightclubs.
Because, that's a huge
because
thing, because then they're going to support
the customers
you.
Pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third reason was that I would pitch it from the stage. I would say to the audience something along the lines of, if you've enjoyed what you saw tonight, please come back before the end of the week because I change the show every night. Bring your friends, you'll see something you haven't seen.
There you go.
And for that reason, I used to set a lot of house records, you know, for the best Thursday or something, but you know, because people would come back.
Mm-hmm.
And so during this period of 13 years where that was my primary work, I broke in a ridiculous amount of material.
Now, were you already the wearing all black boo saying Max Maven at that time, or did that slowly evolve over time?
Well, pretty much. The wardrobe didn't, I suppose there were some small remnants of color up until the 1980-ish.
Why did you make the choice?
Well,
don't get me wrong, I wear all black all the time too, so I completely
No,
approve,
it was just, at some point it occurred, I always favored black as an aesthetic choice.
Uh-huh.
And at some point in the late 1970s, I realized that my wardrobe had sort of gravitated to being about 85% black.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of said, well, why are you hedging?
Yeah.
So I just stopped buying anything that wasn't black. So I think there were a few dark colored shirts that survived a while past that decision.
The last of the yellow blazers.
I would love to see your closet. It's just all black.
Yeah.
You have to sort by texture.
He has black walls in his apartment.
This I've heard.
I think it's so interesting. Like you're mentioning the names of places that I haven't thought about in years, but I remember, you know, Kenmore Square, Pooh's mm-hmm. Pub, Lucifer's. I remember that I went to Emerson College, and that right. was right down
not,
there,
not far from there. Yeah,
and you know, every morning I'd go over to I'd get a donut over at Dunkin' Donuts, and then go to Strawberries and look at the records. They had a record store there, and it's interesting that I went to college with a bunch of guys who were in a comedy workshop, and I was briefly, but those guys, you know, 6 years later, got into the comedy field, you know, gradually. And those
one
guys,
of them was Dennis.
Dennis Leary,
Leary,
Eddie Brill, mm-hmm. Mario Cantone, were all in my yeah. class, and they well, actually, some of those guys
that,
were
that
around. Was, that
I never really got into. I left Boston. Moved to LA in late 78.
Right, yeah.
So I really missed. I was in
was
the
right
very beginning of Boston comedy.
Yes, that
you
was
guys
right.
Kind
at
of
the
like,
beginning.
I did you guys, like, could have high
I mean,
five
Leno
in the
was
air.
Just.
Same with Joe.
Leno was just.
Leno was
just
a few
starting.
Years before me, yeah. Uh huh. Yeah.
Leno was starting. I was on a bill with Leno a couple of times back then. So it was just. There were no full out comedy clubs yet in Boston, but there were. Some restaurants that were trying it out
right.
one night a week or that sort of thing. So I kind of missed being part of the Boston comedy scene. I knew two or three guys who were about the same age as I was who were just starting out. But by the time the Boston comedy scene really started to define itself...
That was in like 82, 83.
And I was already now based on the West Coast.
I remember getting a shot to write some stuff right out of college. And that was right around 1980. And then I went back later that year, and I ran into Dennis Leary, who I knew from, we had taken a couple of comedy writing classes, and he was big in our comedy workshop, and he was kind of like working nights, you know, in like a chemical plant, and also like he was doing a little teaching at the school, because he was just starting to break into comedy clubs. They were just starting around that time, and you know, the guys who got in on it at that time, you know, went on to have pretty successful careers doing it. But I think it's fascinating. That it was all kind of ramping up around that mm-hmm. that time, and out on the West Coast, things like the Comedy Store and the Improv were already up and running.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you go to those clubs here when you were here? Did you work in some of those places?
Yes, but in slightly unusual ways. I worked. The Comedy Store, I never worked in a standard way.
Right.
But they had, probably still have, a room called the Belly Room.
Yes.
Which is a second floor, kind of self-contained room behind the club proper.
Uh-huh.
It's called the Belly Room, people assume, because of belly laughs. But actually, it's because years ago, when the club was called Ciro's, before it was a comedy club, that was where they had the belly dancers.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Huh.
At any rate, I did a run of, I think it was 6 weeks.
Wow.
In the Belly Room, where I did, it was either three or four nights a week. I think it was three, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, but might have included Sunday. Anyway, but this was in the early 80s. So I did a run of 6 weeks there. And then at the Improv, I did a run where I was doing like one Sunday a month.
Mm-hmm.
Was Max Night, and I was doing like a full, you know, most of the time at the Improv it was people doing short sets,
right?
But I was doing like an hour and 20, but it was like the last Sunday of each month, and mm-hmm. that stretched out over I don't remember how many months. So I have performed at both of those venues, but not in the kind of standard
open mic nights and the headliners and guys like that, stuff like that, yeah.
Fascinating. So when you were in there performing at comedy clubs and stuff, mm-hmm. you were doing mentalism for these audiences.
Yeah.
So is that you? We were talking about you sort of transitioning into the character that you know Max Maven mm-hmm. later became. Because that wasn't. Are we allowed to say that wasn't your given name that you chose that?
Yeah.
Okay. We're not going to say what the old name was. But you are published. I mean, I don't know how much you care about this stuff. I don't know how private you are.
We don't need.
Well, it's not that difficult to track it down. But
yeah.
I just don't even think of that other name.
Well, because you chose your name, which I think that we should all get like a temporary name when we're little that our parents hope we'll grow into be, because so many kids are stuck. I mean, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow's child, Apple, is kind of screwed. We were talking about how that character had transitioned over time. When you were performing at these comedy clubs, were you the Max Maven we know now? Were you doing that kind of material? Were you more funny? I can't really see you in a pair of big pants with a ill-fitting tie doing kind of material, but like, what were you doing?
Well, first of all, to the best of my knowledge, during that period of approximately 78 to 91,
yeah.
13 years, as far as I know, I was the only non-comedian who was pretty much full-time headlining the American Comedy Club circuit.
Wow, okay. So non-comedian, there we go. That answers my question.
I'm not aware. There were some magicians at the time who were middling, doing middle sets.
Okay.
There were a couple of magicians who very late in that period, as coming toward 1991, which is when I stopped, there were people like Matt King, for example, who worked his way into headlining. Mm-hmm. So by the time I left, Mac was a headliner. There were a few others, but for the bulk of that 13 years, I don't think there was anybody else doing the consistent headlining work that I was doing.
Did you want a glass?
And I wasn't a comedian. I never said that I was a comedian. I got my share of laughs. I think it was. I don't think the audiences were unhappy with what they got.
Sure, sure.
But it was not comedy per se. It was comedic. There were solid amounts of laughter in the show. When I started working, I did a lot of experimenting, and there was a period in the late 70s that lasted less than a year, but rumors about it persisted many years later. I went through a period, this was not at comedy clubs, I will say, but there was a brief period where I came up with this theory of psychic rape. Which sounds very horrible when you actually say
it.
It
sounds like a laugh riot, Max. That's great.
No, but the idea was that if you were in a room with a man who could really read your mind, who could really invade your mind,
yes,
it would be, in a sense, like psychic rape.
It is.
He could forcibly enter your private area. And so I theorized that, therefore, if I was going to be an effective mind reader, I should make my audience uncomfortable, that there should be an edge of discomfort in my show. This was a terrific idea in theory and a terrible idea in practice.
Interesting.
And I dropped it after a couple of months, I think. But words sort of got out, so there were people who said, oh yeah, he's terribly unfunny and grim. And so this never jibed with the fact that I was headlining comedy clubs, but no, I was the persona functioned very well with with humor, as it does today.
Absolutely. I mean, you're very dry and observant, and quite frequently will say things to an audience that they're already thinking, which really goes along with it, but it's smarter than the way that they were articulating it in their own heads, which is nice, because it A, goes along with the fact that you're a mind reader, but B, puts you back in that position of authority, which I think it also bears to mention. You've chosen black, arguably the most powerful of all the colors to wear. You have very sharp angles in your facial features and the expressions that you make. They're deliberately settled upon. But none of it is contrived. It's all part of who you are. And so going back to your initial theory that little boys get into magic for power, I would say that you've honed and refined that to the nth degree. And not only that, but you've chosen the most in control. Stop that right now. That's gross. But you've chosen.
She was talking to me, by the way.
I was licking Paul's arm, and it's just repugnant. Oh. So, Max, you have to stop if I'm going to. So you need to make eye contact with me. So
I think what you're trying to say is there's nobody that can hold a room better than Max Maven.
That is also true.
Right.
Yes, that's part of what I'm saying. I'm also saying that divination, and it's not mentalism isn't all divination, but to a large part it is, You have to be the most in control and the most powerful person in the room. And that extends from who you are. It's not because you just do that. You don't just wander into a room and have no one notice. When you walk into a room, people can't help but look at you. You've got that it, you know, that star okay. quality thing that they always talk about that people try to get, but they can't.
That's what I was trying to say earlier when I was giving you the compliment that wasn't really a compliment.
What did you do?
I don't know what I did.
The one thing that I would bring up on that, and I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying, but I don't think my motivations are the same as when I was seven.
Well, agreed.
And the need for leverage and power.
No, but you understood it inherently is what I was.
Yes, thinking. But although that is still very much a part of the persona, mm-hmm. It's no longer a struggle.
Well, yeah, exactly, because you grew into it. You grew up, and it just became who you are instead of what you wanted to be.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating to me that you would say, this is something I desire, and very much like everything else you've ever had and done in your life, you just went and got it. Not only did you get it, but you got it in spades. It is so remarkable to me. But I think that it's really interesting going back to the power that so much of your persona and character exudes it, and it was a lesson that you learned as such a little boy, you know, like, but you just sort of brought it up, honed, refined it, learned it, and now live it. And I think it's really cool. So while we were sitting here, I wrote down, like, you could look at all these. Yeah. These are questions for you and things that I want you to talk about. So if your voice gets tired,
I have questions as well.
I know. I'll let you ask mine because I've been asking. Go ahead.
Mine are personal questions. Oh, they're not really personal. But when we were talking about decades, I think we ended with the 70s and early 80s. Is that right?
Well, in the 80s, in the late 70s is when I moved to L.A., and in the 80s, late 70s into 91, my primary work was doing the comedy clubs.
At what point did you become a member of the Magic Castle?
Well, I worked the castle, the first time I worked the castle was at the invitation of Bill Larson.
Ha ha! He signed your application.
He and Di Verna.
Oh, stop my it, application. Right? Oh, smell you.
Yeah.
Well. That was last week's podcast.
So I worked the castle the first time in I believe it was January of 77.
You worked it before you became a member.
I have to be honest, I don't remember when I joined.
I can look it up.
Well, I'd be
curious. What are you asking
know,
us for, membership director?
I didn't know that I was going to
be
here.
I worked the castle at the beginning of 77. I came back again a year later because I was nominated for Lecturer of the Year. I might have come back one time in between those two. And then by late 78, I had moved to L.A. So I had worked the club a few times.
So you were at the club before you even moved to L.A.?
Yeah, that was my first time ever on the West Coast. It was in early 77.
Oh, wow.
To come work
to
the come castle.
For the castle. Wow.
And so I honestly don't remember when I joined. I might have joined that first trip. I probably didn't. I probably
I'm
going to
look it up.
I don't know that I waited until I was actually living here to join. That might have been the case, but I have a feeling I joined before that.
Okay. Huh. I'll look it up. That was my question.
Oh, okay, good question.
It's all about what I want to know.
Well, I'm sure there are other people that want to know. For those of you at home who don't know, I talk about Trish all the time, but I never talk about what she does for a living, I don't think. She's the membership director at the Magic Castle. So if you are interested in becoming a member of the Magic Castle, she is the
you
person.
You have to make it past
with.
Her.
Yeah.
Yes.
She is the gatekeeper.
Are you the keymaster?
It is true.
No, she's the gatekeeper. The keymaster's a dude.
Yeah, I said, are you?
Am I? Am I? Oh, the audience.
Yes.
Well, all right. I posted a bunch of pictures of movies behind the scenes today on Twitter, and one of them was of Stay Puffed walking, and it showed how little he actually was and how they had built the city up around.
I looked at them.
Did you see them? They're
great.
Yeah,
I want to
see
that. Kind of sad.
Yeah, well, see, that's what I was interesting because I asked people. I said, "Does knowing the secret spoil this for you?" Because as a magician, that's the question I want to know. Because so many people, I think that they're, and I'm sure that you have wonderful theories on this, and I'd be curious to find out what they are, but I've always contended that there are three types of people who watch magic. Mm-hmm. People who already know how it's done, whether they're right or wrong. They're going to tell you exactly how you did it. Oh, well, you built a hole in the floor and you ran the 15 feet under a tunnel they put in. Whether they're right or wrong, they already know, because they can't be told that they don't. There are people who don't want to know. Don't tell me, because I love to believe that there are fairies and magic and stuff out there.
That's me. That's me too.
Don't tell me anything. And then there are people who do want to know, and when they find out, it deepens their appreciation for the art.
Or it disappoints them. There are four types.
No, the people about the fairies and elves.
I have a long held comment about that. A lot of the time, people will say, magicians will say, if I told you the secret of this magic, you'd be disappointed.
Uh-huh. Oh, I disagree.
And my counter to that is, if you learn the secret to a piece of magic, and we're presuming it's a reason, it's not a piece of crap, that it's a piece of magic.
Legitimate, yeah.
And it's disappointing, that means you just didn't understand it. Because if it worked, if it produced the magic, then by definition, it can't be disappointing. It has to be interesting. It has to be...
Yeah.
Something has to be good about it. Mm-hmm. Something has to be worthwhile about it. Now, it may be disappointing in the sense that you were hoping for something more practical, or you were hoping for something more elegant, or you were hoping for something... more wacky.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that has to do with issues other than the method and the magic.
Got it.
You know? Does that sort of make sense?
It makes sense. Totally mm-hmm. makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I call that third type of people who are really genuinely interested, I call them the God of Knows. And those are the type of people that I usually won't tell, but I'll send them in a direction where they can discover it for themselves. Mm-hmm. Because they are usually like, oh my gosh, it's amazing, because the psychology behind the trick, or the physics of the trick, or the scientific application that has allowed the trick to happen or be, it really is genuinely fascinating to a true student who's asking the question for the right reason. I had a guy in the seance room the other day who said, well, you need to tell me how you did that teacup. And I said, no, I don't.
And he said,
yes, you do. You need to tell me right now. If I had a secret, I would tell you. And I said, but here's the thing. I don't care about your secrets.
Yeah.
And I said,
brava.
You? No, I don't. This is my job. I did this. And I said, I'm not doing this by anything that you could not learn or discover with a simple inquiry into magic and some of the things that we use. And I said, so go to a magic shop and start asking questions, and start buying effects, and start researching and reading. And I gave him a couple things to read, and I said, get out, asshole.
They really need to go to the grocery store and get some sugar.
Yeah, go to the grocery store and get some sugar. Yes, absolutely, because that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. That's all they need.
When did you start bringing macabre stuff into your show? Was it always there?
Well, I think that predates my involvement with magic per se. I mean, from...
Good
as early as I can remember, as a little kid, I was drawn to weird stuff.
You were a baby creeper.
Bold.
You know,
monsters and
the
famous monsters of filmland and
horror comics, things like that.
All that stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
I loved Charles Addams cartoons when I was a kid.
Oh, absolutely.
Even before the Addams Family.
So yeah. I think that probably that type of taste, if you will.
Yeah.
Predates my involvement with magic, because I'm sure that goes back to before I was seven.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, from the earliest I can remember having aesthetic choices.
I have to ask, jumping back to Massachusetts for a second, mid-60s, Wakefield, Massachusetts, Pleasure Island. Did you ever go?
Boy, I think I did. I went to several amusement parks.
Yeah.
As a kid and adolescent, and that one sounds awful familiar.
They had Moby Dick.
That's the one I remember, is they had this thing called the Moby Dick ride, where you would get in a boat. It was like
it was like
the Jungle Cruise at Disneyland, only it was actually on a bigger pond, and you would go by these headhunter huts that were out on the water, and then you'd see bubbles in the water, and the 70-foot long white whale.
Was it really 70?
Okay, I can tell you for sure I never did that right.
Seven.
Oh, okay. Because
I'd remember that.
I
would absolutely remember that.
I remember that, and I remember looking at that and going like,
So either I went to Pleasure Island and got gypped because I didn't get to go on the Moby Dick ride, okay, or I never got there and just remember the name.
Okay. Yeah. That was the big draw.
I'm guessing the latter.
That was a big draw, was the Moby Dick ride. So I just wondered if you'd ever seen that.
Been trying to tell me for years that when they got rid of the park, they just let Moby Dick go and they just cut him and it just dropped down into the big lake. And I thought, man, if I could get my hands on a diver, I would send them and have them bring home its eye.
Wouldn't it still be there?
Still there. That's what he's thinking. It'd be all rusted out, and this big old rusty, funky whale.
It's now what's known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Yes.
There's actually an office park there, but you can still see the lake that he was in, the big pond. And I know.
Oh, this is a true story.
I know that if I ever go there, I'm going to go around the edge of the pond and I'm going to kick over some 50-year-old wiring that still works, and when one last spark, he's going to lurch out, smash down on top of me, and just drag me into the depths.
Like, how great is that?
Like, this is Ahab. The kind of shit he makes up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And he can't sleep because he's so worried that Moby Dick is going to leap out of the water when he's walking through
the park. I hate Moby Dick more than Ahab.
You know what? I can't with you. I want to get that thing's eyeball and put it in a big frame and put it in the house.
It needs to be in this house.
Huh?
It needs to be in this house. Can I do a side note and let everybody know that my view this evening is of the, what is this guy called?
Tasmanian tiger. His name is Hobart.
Okay.
Hobart the thylacine?
Getting ready to eat Max Maven's head.
Will you please take a photograph of this for our viewers? Our listeners.
Yeah, who don't know that Hobart, who doubt Hobart.
And also a little leaf above the head.
Yes, which he keeps hitting with his hand. He gesticulates.
Hobart, say something to our listeners, will you? Okay. He actually does pipe up from time to time.
Yeah, he talks.
Yeah, he does talk.
Yeah.
Which one is
smart? I've contacted friends of mine who are about the same age who grew up there, and they don't remember Moby Dick, and they don't have the same attachment.
I don't think it's true. I don't think it exists.
Well, the last person I asked about was Beth Bornstein. I said, remember Wakefield, Massachusetts?
No.
Pleasure Island? No. You remember Moby Dick? Oh, is that the dumb thing with the ride with the whale? I don't know.
That's not how Beth speaks.
Sort of.
It's not.
Okay. All right. Very little. You know, amusement parks, the spiritual and the whooshy and the theatrical, are what stick with her. Giant whales assaulting little boys, dragging them out of
which is not
boats
true
to their deaths. Happened. It happened.
It never dragged you out to your death.
No, it got the kid next to me. It wanted me, but
you know what?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Not about me tonight. Let's go back.
Jesus Christ.
And my whale phobia.
You sound like me, Misty. Jesus Christ. For
what's the
love of...
What's the first thing you published, Max? Listen to Deuce. He just does not care, but I do. So,
the question was what?
What was the first thing you published?
I believe... I think the first thing I ever had in print was in 1965.
Wow.
You were a wee nubbins of a thing.
There was a magic dealer located in Buffalo, New York, named Gene Gordon. And Gene Gordon used to write a column for a magazine called The New Tops, which was published out of Colon, Michigan, the Abbott's Magic Company. And Gene Gordon's column, at that time in the 60s, he wrote a column called Patter and Presentation.
Okay.
And basically the column was readers would send in routines for existing magic tricks. You know, here's the patter I use or the presentation I use for this trick that most or many readers own. And so I sent him one and he published it.
Nice.
Wow.
That must have been very gratifying for little you, who had spent your 5 cents and 10 cents on Abras and other periodicals to finally see your name in one. How did that feel?
I still have a thing for magazines. I've written about this, that I do a lot of reading, not only in the magic field, but I love books and I love magazines. A good book is like a painting. And a good magazine is like a photograph. Mm-hmm. You know, a book is something that normally has been crafted over a period of time, and it reflects what's gone on over the course of a year or several years. And a magazine doesn't have that kind of luxurious schedule, because magazines come out weekly or monthly. Mm-hmm. So they are not as leisurely in their construction as a book can be, which is why I think a magazine is more like a snapshot. But the word snapshot sounds like a cheap throwaway, and I don't mean that. Mm-hmm. But it's a photograph in the sense that a photograph is really of the moment.
Correct. Yeah.
Right.
So I like them both, and I like them. You know, I would not wish to have to choose between paintings or books, and paintings or photographs. And so, in the same way, I would not wish to have to choose between books and magazines.
When you mentioned it was published in Michigan, it just I felt a little bit of a twitch of sadness, because their magazines have been cutting back over the years, and one of the things that I miss is the local or regional magazine, the regional newspaper, things like that. Mm-hmm. That before it got so globalized, and before it all got down to, we can just sit here and you know, have anything on our phones or computers. Yep. And everything.
Yeah, but Max doesn't keep a cell phone. He doesn't need one. He takes care of his business, and he's organized. And he's,
right.
He's one of few people that I know that does not, and it's not that you're really resistant to it, you just don't.
Oh, no, I'm really resistant.
Why?
To it. I don't want to have a cell phone.
You don't want us to be able to find you?
Well, I don't want a cell phone for several reasons, and one reason is the simple pragmatic fact that it's one more piece of stuff that you carry.
True.
Around, and I don't want to have more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Than I need to.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, I'm old enough, you know, I like technology. I'm not,
oh, I know,
I'm
you're
not
very
a lot
tech savvy. You got an iPad.
I got lots of electronic gizmos,
which you can equip with cell phones.
But there are things, you know, I grew up with the notion that a phone is something that's in your home, attached by a cord to your wall. And if
Man
you're not
Smith.
There, you know, the answering machine I thought was a great, great invention.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one of the first ones.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Back in 70, whatever. But I mean, when they were really brand new and
mm-hmm.
expensive and
And they were
primitive.
As big as the table in our living room.
And I thought that was a great step forward. Now, even when you were out, there were someone could leave a message for you.
Sure.
I thought that was about as far as you needed to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in this room grew up that way, just so you know.
Yeah, but you're a kid. Anyway,
I remember cords.
I don't like the
and
idea that
dials.
Someone can find me at any moment.
Yeah,
I don't like that either.
I don't like that. But the worst of it, that's not the worst of it. And I absolutely appreciate that cell phones are useful and,
sure.
mm-hmm. and functional. And I'm not I'm not too good to use a cell phone if I'm
right.
with someone. They've got a cell phone and I need to make a call. I won't.
Shit, we've been standing in a magic shop and Alan Bursky's called you on my phone.
Well,
and I've had to hand it over.
So I don't. But I do think that in many ways the cell phone is has led to the death of civility.
Interesting.
Every time I find myself thinking, well, you know, it would be convenient to have a cell phone.
Yeah.
Because I'm standing online and I could be using that time or whatever. And when I'm thinking that, a moment later I find myself, let's say, in a supermarket next to someone who's screaming at the top of his or her lungs, I'm buying tomatoes, as if the world needs to know this. And I don't want to be part of that process.
See, I do that without a phone in my hand.
And I've also found I've also found that when I will be out at a meal or for coffee with someone who is an otherwise very well-bred human being,
mm-hmm.
and that phone rings, and they'll stop in the middle of a conversational sentence to answer that phone.
Oh, I don't mind.
Oh, I hate that.
No.
Oh my God, Max!
I don't want to be part of that process.
Yeah.
All three of us, uh-huh. I have noticed during this podcast, have been on our cell phones, and I would like to just now add that I was on my cell phone researching you. So Mine was not rude. I don't know what Misty Leo was doing over there.
Paul and Misty are receiving questions via Twitter and Facebook Maven.
Oh.
So I would like to...
Questions?
Remember that time that guy walked into the seance room and we said, we're going to need you to goff right now? And you were like, yeah, we both are going to need you to goff. Because he just kept pushing his way into the room. That's kind of what I need you to do right now.
Oh.
Just kidding. So, I have all these questions for me, and then we have all these other questions from a bunch of other people.
Well, let's start this off with just a basic one. What is mentalism for our audience who might not be aware? And your philosophy.
And then what is mentalism to you?
Yeah, your philosophy behind it. Oh.
The word mentalism, up until very recently, was pretty much unknown to the public. That's changed because of the television series, which came along a couple of years ago.
The Mentalist, yeah.
And now...
Have you done any work on that?
No.
Oh, okay.
But now apparently a mentalist is someone who looks like Simon Baker, so I'm fine with that.
yeah, baby.
but I avoided using the term up until the last couple of years.
You just referred to yourself as a magician?
No, if I had to use one term to pigeonhole myself... I would use mind reader. It's not accurate per se, but at least it tells you the kind of general direction of what I do.
Do you find there's a stigma behind the term mentalist or something? Or?
No, the problem was that up until recently, when as I say, it gained definition because of the television series, if you said mentalist, the first thing most people thought of was an escapee from an institution. It just sounded like something to do with a mental
impairment. Yeah.
Impairment, yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, the term predates what we now call theatrical mentalism. It was actually in the late 19th century, before the term was taken into show business. It referred to a philosophical movement.
Interesting.
Oh, wow.
There was some movement called mentalism, about which I know nothing except the name. But but it's just not a very useful term.
Mm-hmm.
And people debate constantly within the field as to what it actually means, what officially gets sanctioned by that term. To me, it just means any kind of entertainment that is mental, that involves the mind. So that would include not only what I do, but it would also include people who do memory demonstrations or lightning calculation. Hypnosis fits in under that umbrella, and so forth. So to me, it's such a wide-ranging term that it's not terribly useful. It no longer has the added burden of not being intelligible to most people.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, it's just not very clear. So I still don't use it very much.
Do aspects like cold reading or anything fall into mentalism?
Well, it certainly can. Mm-hmm. Certainly can, yeah.
Because I find I'm very fascinated with the skeptic world and culture and society.
Yeah, me too.
And I find that a lot of them have sort of just a not favorable quality towards cold reading, John Edwards type people, stuff like that.
Well, I think there's a reasonably good basis for that opinion. I mean, I think John Edwards is a creep who's profiting off of the sorrows of other people. That's not a very...
Yeah.
I don't think that warrants support. I have a long relationship with the skeptical community.
I love that lecture with James
long-term
Randi
friends
a couple
with,
years ago.
With James Randi. And if you look on the net, I interviewed Randi twice at the Magic Castle. Mm-hmm. The first time it was about 2 hours. The second time it was like an hour and a half.
I was there
and
for
it's
both
all,
of them.
It's all on the net. It's all easy to find.
Wonderful.
I've been friends with a number of the major... players, if you will, in the skeptical movement, which began in the 70s, really the modern movement, and I'm friends with, or at least have met most of the major names in that field.
Johnny Carson being one of them.
Never met Carson.
Phil Platt.
Bill. Yes, I've met him. I've been to the TAM convention, which is the amazing meeting, which is what the Jane Friendly Educational Foundation does this event once a year in Vegas, and I performed. I'm good friends with DJ Grothy, who's the president of JREF, as well as longtime friends with Jane Friendly, and various others connected with all of that, including Jamie Ian Swiss, and just quite a number of people who are connected to all of this, Michael Shermer and Ray Hyman, and I'll stop before I...
Can I ask a question?
I'll stop before I overtly name too many people but leave out one important one or something.
Yeah,
so.
Can I ask a question that in itself sounds like a contradiction? Yeah. What do the skeptics believe in?
I don't think there's a single answer to that because I think modern skepticism, there's a kind of a range of beliefs, if you will. One of the fascinating things for me is that at the moment, as I was starting to say, I'm connected to this movement, but I'm not part of it per se. I performed my full evening show for The Amazing Meeting 2 years ago. And then at this last one this year, I gave a talk and participated in a panel discussion. And the talk in particular was very well received because I wasn't an insider preaching to the choir, but nor was I an opponent or an adversary. And one of the things that's happening right now in the skeptical movement is there's a lot of dissension going on over the issue of atheism. And
I've heard of that.
Is atheism simply a branch of skepticism, or is it something separate? Is it something that must be included? So if you're a skeptic, you also have to be an atheist. I think there are members of the skeptical community who would answer that question with a big yes. There are others who would say absolutely not necessary. There are others who would say, I believe strongly in atheism, but I wish it to be held separate from skepticism. But I mean, it's really tangled.
Is it
at the
religion
moment.
Of being skeptic?
Well, that's what I've been noticed, that there are some folks who have been so outspoken about atheism that they almost evangelical atheism.
Yeah, family members like that definitely.
Right.
A lot of people.
Well, there's zealotry in any belief system, including a belief system that is willful disbelief. I think that there are certainly members of the skeptical movement who can be put onto different places if you were to make a chart.
Sure.
You know, I look at almost like a political spectrum. If we look at belief systems, then let's say that on the so-called far left, would be deeply religious believers, and not simply in the classical religions, but also Wiccans and ritual magicians and all of those. And then you move into, I suppose you could say, liberalism, which is vaguely, believers who don't necessarily follow the doctrines of a specific church or what have you. And then moderates, and then conservatives, and then as you get further to the right, you get evangelicals, who feel it is their duty and their responsibility to convert others to share their beliefs. And I don't, and I have friends on every part of that spectrum.
Sure.
And depending on which, I mean, I would put myself somewhere left of center, but not at the extreme left, and on some things fairly moderate, I suppose. But I find that just as with politics, what we think of as a straight line with an extreme left and an extreme right is actually more of a circle.
Yeah, that's what
I
found.
And the extreme left and the extreme right are much closer to each other than than we sort of think of it.
I find like two guys who are opposing can stand like this, you know, and then they bend so far backwards from each other they could actually kind of shake hands underneath here.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what Max just said, yeah.
So you do find some people on the extreme end of the skeptical spectrum, or whatever you want to call it, who proselytize, and which it's I think that's a perfectly valid worldview.
Sure,
it's just not mine. My attitude toward other people's belief systems, I'm fairly benign about it. I'm not terribly upset if someone believes things other than what I do, as long as what they believe doesn't involve beating me up.
Yeah.
That's kind of my general
pushing
policy.
Their ideas on you.
Now, there are people in the skeptical movement who would say, with some validity, yes, but what about belief systems that wind up being harmful to the person, to the believer?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And there are certainly some very clear-cut examples where this is the case. I mean, if we just stick to the area, for example, of physical medicine.
Sure.
You have issues of people who are using alternative medical stuff that kills them.
Yes.
Or harms them.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have belief systems where that say you're not allowed to use any kind of medical help.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've got cases recently in the news that crop up more often than is comforting of kids who die because their parents refuse to bring them in for medical attention because their belief systems say against it. So it's not as simple as, I mean, that's, you know, the kid who dies under that circumstance, technically neither the kid nor the kid's parents beat me up, and yet I can't say I support their worldview. So my comment is a bit overly simplistic.
Yeah, when I've shot a penicillin, it means the difference between life and death, and you know it does, and the parents refuse to see it.
Yeah. So it's not all that simple, and the people who do proselytize are not doing so based purely on. It's not a whim. I mean, they believe in the validity of what they're saying, and in many cases, there is validity. It's it isn't simple. I'll just leave it at that.
Right. Now, is any topic open for open for skepticism when you meet, or is...
Is any topic open for skepticism?
What do you mean?
Like, I don't know,
like Santa Claus? What are you asking?
Well, I don't know. Skepticism is a big...
Well, when you meet, what? First of all, when he meets, with whom?
Do you have...
At the
society?
Docks. At the docks every Wednesday.
Oh, my God.
No,
but it sounded like you had...
I'm not teasing you. I'm genuinely asking you.
I don't know. Maybe I didn't understand, but it sounded like there were meetings, like
skeptics. Well, it's a skeptic society.
This particular group, JREF, has a convention once a year, which the other groups do as well. It's in their convention is in Vegas. It gets over 1,000 people, and it lasts over a weekend, and consists of a lot of events. Most of them are talks,
panels like Comic-Con,
and panels exactly. And they don't cover only a single thing, but they tend to gravitate around many of the same things. So
sure.
So okay. Particularly recently, not surprisingly, you have. People who are concerned about climate change denial, for example, has certainly grown in significance recently for obvious reasons. Issues of alternative medicine are discussed a great deal. Just restoring science to the public center is obviously
something that's
that gets
a huge
discussed
one.
About a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and
I've been there are actually some dirty words floating around in cartoons these days that I've become aware about of that they don't want mentioned, you know,
like
birthdays, because they don't want kids to feel left out, and because not every kid is able to celebrate a birthday. But the other one is dinosaurs.
Christmas.
Kids love dinosaurs. Wow. Well, Christmas has long been a taboo, but Halloween, because...
This is because you might offend... the dinosaurs thing is because you might offend a fundamentalist parent.
Right, and evolution who, you can't
believes that the Earth is 5,000 years old.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Am I allowed to say f*** them on this podcast?
Devil dinosaur...
You're encouraged to say that.
Devil dinosaur would be a hot potato if he wasn't already a pre-existing Marvel character, because there you've got...
Devil and
the
dinosaur.
Devil and a dinosaur, yeah. but
they portray him as a dog, so it's very much like the Flintstones dog. You know,
he's like Dino, you know. It's like we don't. Wow. But he's
has he been on? Have you aired a Devil dinosaur episode?
Yet? Yeah, he's been on. It's just that he is their pet. But you know, I'm sure someone can nitpick and everything. But he's been a part of the Marvel universe for I don't know 38 years now or something like that. So. You know, it would be like Daredevil, you know, people getting upset with Daredevil because Devil is in his name, or the Tasmanian Devil, you know, Son of Satan, who's a Marvel character, we're probably not going to do a Spider-Man. But.
Well, it's really interesting how some of those things change.
Yeah.
Back in the early 90s, Genie magazine, which is now 75 years old, is the longest running independent magic magazine in the world. And now
Free to Magic Castle members.
Yes.
Magician members, yes.
Yeah. Oh, and it was started here in LA.
Yes.
By William Larson Sr.
Maven's Magic Castle.
No, that was William Larson Jr.
Oh,
William Larson Sr. started Genie. William Larson Jr. took it over when his father
as an editor, right?
As the editor.
Along with Irene.
And he, along with his wife Irene and his brother Milt, the three of them, Bill Jr., Milt, Irene, founded the Magic Castle.
Mm-hmm.
But Genie magazine, back at some point in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, I guess, Dante Larson, Bill's son, was then editing the magazine, and he noticed that issue 666 was coming up.
Which happens to be his membership number.
I did know that. So he put together he put together a special issue of Genie,
mm-hmm.
which, not surprisingly, involved lots of kind of devil gags,
mm-hmm.
and got some very upset mail.
Really?
Oh, wow.
From people who got very angry at him and at anybody and everyone who had been involved in producing that special issue, which of course included me. So. So I got to see a lot of this angry mail. It was really before the internet was fully up and running, otherwise it would have been even crazier. But there were some people who canceled subscriptions. And and there was one woman who I never met her, so I don't know, but just basing this on the handwriting and such, I presume she was youngish, like in her 20s, but who wrote this
Hearts
letter that she said she was going to be writing to every dealer who advertised in Genie to tell them to stop because this was so immoral to spread satanic imagery in magic. And at the end of her letter mentioned that she'd been in magic for a year, which would explain why she apparently hadn't come to realize that every famous magician up until about 1950, at least until 1950, maybe later, every famous magician who did any kind of advertising at one point or another used devil imagery.
Yeah.
It was standard, and so you can find posters from Houdini and
Thurston
and Keller and Blackstone and Dante and all of the others and all the dealers and so forth. I mean, it's just filled with devil imagery.
Hysterical. I hope she's not a member.
And
she'd be scared walking through the halls.
I have a feeling she dropped out of magic shortly thereafter.
One of my favorite
was a lost cause for her.
One of my favorite covers that we ever did on the Zatanna comic book, Adam Hughes did this great cover of Zatanna proudly showing off a winning number, you know, a card that she had selected that had her, you know, her number on it. I think it was number 13, issue 13. And there were all these traditional red devil sprites with the wrong cards going like, and they're all really
angry. That sounds like a poster.
Yeah, I mean, they
did look at old magic posters and appropriate them for his.
Uh-huh.
Zatanna, do you know who Zatanna is, Max?
Sort of.
Okay, she's the reason we actually met. Zatanna is a female magician in DC Comics lore. who is now a member of the Justice League and is sort of rising to prominence, no small part because of your contributions to her mythos, but yeah. At least that's my opinion, but then whatever.
Well,
but
she's kind of a D-lister.
Very closely resembles...
What?
Very closely resembles this one over here.
Yeah, she kind of does. A little bit. Huh?
Put a top hat on and...
Yeah, but anyway, she's a female magician who says things backwards and can do real magic.
Would that it were that easy.
She's a witch.
Right? She's a witch! But she's, you know, that actually brings me to a question that I wanted to ask you about. The question actually says, as a specialist in magic of the mind,
yes.
And yet a member, a skeptic, renowned skeptic, because one of my questions here was, what are your opinions of psychic powers? But you've already given that to us, and so
I crossed
that off my, huh?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay, well, good, then that's the first question. What are your opinion of real psychic powers? But the second follow-up to the question is... Do you have them?
Find out next week whether Max Maven has psychic powers on Radio Rashi. This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter @RadioRashi or @Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.
This takes me back to my days of night clubbing.
Mm-hmm. You used to eat the ice cream cones?
No, when I used to perform.
When you used to perform?
I had that trained seal burlesque act.
Paul, I can't even... You know what? No.
You didn't have a... talking dancing bear or something like Lord Byron.
No, I had a seal named Minnie who'd come out and do most of Lily Sincere's old act while
I
played on the horn.
I want to get a better picture of Max.
Well, the only thing I could play was How Dry I Am. I used to hit it with my nose and she would strip and then do a balloon number.
Why are you not recording this? Because this is your outro right now. Jesus.
You are?
He's so full of shit. His eyes are brown. It's unbelievable.
It's true. I was on a double bill with Joe Alasky.
You know what?
What are you talking about?
He's just making stuff up.
I was talking. I didn't want to go on while Max was talking, but I was talking about my days early on in doing performing in nightclubs.
None of which happened.
It's true.
It's really not.
We were run out of town. We were run out of so many towns.
You had some bad hecklers.
What? Well, no.
You know what? This is actually a true story. Oh, first of all, I had guys
throwing fish and distracting the seal.
What?
Minnie would be up there doing her...
Minnie? Her name was Minnie.
Her name was Minnie.
The moocher.
No.
Unbelievable.
Minnie the mammal.
Minnie the mammal.
She was a...
Worst act ever.
No, she was wonderful. She was a trained sea lion.
Trained wreck is what she was.
And I trained her to do Lily Sincere's old burlesque act. And I would
She
play.
Did the ball thing?
Yeah. She'd hold it in her flippers. And that was the thing. It's like she had it down, but then people would distract her by throwing fish, and then she'd drop it and then run off. And we never finished the act.
I cannot.
And I was I had to play How Dry I Am on a klaxon horn.
On a klaxon horn?
Wow.
Yeah, you know, like Harpo Marx thing.
No, I know what a klaxon horn is. What I was questioning was the fact that you knew how to play one beyond, are my bicycle's going to hit you?
Well, you know, there's a lot I've forgotten since then.
How dry I am.
It was a great act.
It was not a great act. It's a great lie is what it is. It's not even a good lie, actually. It's a terrible lie.
Max probably introduced us one night.
Max would not have introduced you to run you out of town himself.
Well, we were a very forgettable act, so he might not remember. There was a time I was doing a burlesque seal act during the
Is this the one with the klaxon horns?
Yeah. Oh, you saw it. Yes, right. It was me and Minnie the mammal, the trained sea lion. I trained her how to do Lily Sincere's old act with the ball.
Obviously, he's seen it. He said the klaxon horn.
We were legendary.